So today we're going to move into some initial theory for the course. We finished up this kind of motivating example in the last few classes. Today we're going to start going through and looking at modeling switching losses first in typical hard switching scenarios, but with deference to where we're going, which is looking towards how can we reduce these losses through things like ZVS that we talked about before. But initially, we're going to assume this is just kind of a analysis of switching losses in a typical PWM converter, small ripple type configuration. Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about is synchronous switching. Many of you have seen before in 482 or briefly in 481, but good to review, and also covers the basics of a circuit that we'll look at a fair amount in the next few lectures, which is some kind of series connected MOSFET, what's known as an inductively clamped configuration, which means I've got a fixed amount of current coming in and a fixed bus voltage across these. And as I switch back and forth, my voltages are going to be clamped to some bus voltage, my current is clamped to some inductor current. Assume that IL here, current through the inductance, may vary, but whatever the current that's split between these two devices is really dictated by this inductor. And then the voltage across is some VDC. And as I switch between one of these two devices conducting, what are the dynamics of those switching intervals? Okay. Bears reminding that MOSFET is fundamentally a current bidirectional device, but voltage unidirectional. It means if the gate to source is high, well above threshold, this thing will conduct current in either direction through its on resistance. Okay. If the gate to source is off, this can block voltage, positive drain to source. If I try to put negative drain to source voltage, the MOSFET body dial will turn on. I can't put VDS much less than zero. Okay. That body diode is inherent. When I show a symbol with a source connected body, it means the body diode from the body to drain is going to show up source to drain because the body is short of the source. There's another diode body to source that's shorted out having body connected to source. Okay. So this is now a synchronous implementation where I have two MOSFETs instead of a MOSFET and a diode. If this is a boost converter with the input here and output here, then I could have this be a diode, this be a MOSFET, and it would work, or two MOSFETs. If this is a buck converter, I'd have the input at VDC and the output after IL, then this would be my MOSFET, this could be a diode. In either event, because a diode is a single quadrant switch, a MOSFET is a two quadrant switch, I can always replace a diode with a MOSFET and have things still work. Right. Reasons to do so, motivate a little bit in the example, allowing inductor current to go negative for soft switching, but also may just be for conduction loss. An R on can be lower loss than a VF, depending on my current. Okay. So, abstracting from that, so this is neither a boost nor a buck, but just some general circuit where I have some current, some voltage, and I'm switching back and forth between these two devices. What do those waveforms look like? So I'm going to look at a few things. I'm going to look at, call this guy M1, this guy M2. And I want to look at VDS of the low side device, which I'll call V switch. And minor, I only need to look at the VDS of one device. So the VDS of this device is just going to be VDC minus that. Just going to be flipped and shifted by VDC. As long as I plot this, I know exactly what the waveform is here. Okay. And then I'm also going to look at colors G1 and G2, which are not necessarily the gate to source voltages, but the signals coming into the gate drivers that are telling you which device to turn on, which device to turn off. Just some arbitrary signal level things. If it's high, I'm turning VGS on. Okay. So as I plot the waveforms here, the way I'm going to operate this, if I want to switch back and forth versus time axes, I'm going to have what's known as dead time, where in this interval, G1 is on, I shut it off, turn it back on. Then for my other device, I'm going to switch like this, where there is some small gap where both devices are off. G2. At both transitions, we'll call this TD1, TD2, where both of these are dead times. Which are inserted to make sure that I don't run into a situation where I turn both of these devices on at the same time. I do that, I'll have a low impedance short on a big DC bus, and I'll have a huge spike of current that goes from my DC bus through these two devices, generating a lot of power loss. In theory, if these things switch infinitely fast, I have no other dynamics, no parasitics, I could have zero dead time and switch them both at almost the exact same time, maybe some epsilon apart. In reality, as we'll look at, if G1 and G2 are my signals telling these devices when to switch, once I send those through a gate driver and try to actually change VGS, there's going to be some dynamics associated with that. So if I plot zoomed in, what it might look like, oops, this is time at, let's say, this TD2. Take this and expand it over here. I'll have my dashed lines with what my signals told me for TD2. And my controller at this first dashed line sends a PWM signal to the gate driver that tells G2 to go low. Once it sends that signal, the gate driver will actually start going low. I look at the actual VGS2. See this. Because of resistance and capacitance, it'll kind of fall off and take some time. At the moment, I'm just sketching an arbitrary waveform. Look at the dynamics of that actual waveform in the moment. And then at this time, my VGS1 will be told to go high, the gate driver will begin driving it high, get something like this. Okay. Now, where exactly in these waveforms is the device, where is V or M2 actually turning off and where is M1 actually turning on? Well, it becomes a bit of a gray area when we're in between, neither fully in cutoff nor fully in triode, anywhere in between. One point we might choose to compare is the threshold voltage. These are high power MOSFETs. We're generally driving them at something like 15, 20 volts and have a threshold in the 3 to 4 volt range. So the threshold would be somewhere down here. And if I drew this reasonably, what you'd see is that this time is significantly shorter than whatever my controller told it to be. If I crank these down, if I said send my PWM signals that there's zero dead time, I'd actually have significant overlap here because TD2 is longer than the time down to threshold and up to threshold. Right? So your actual dead time may be different than your signals because of these dynamics. Generally, you need to make sure that you have enough because of the time it takes to actually switch the device. Let's just note that actual dead time, meaning the time where both channels of the devices are off, is maybe smaller than signal dead time or signal command. Because I programmed my controller to have a certain dead time, likely that my real dead time of the circuit is somewhat smaller than that. This was the ETH, the devices. Okay, so to accommodate that, I'm going to put in some dead time. I'll have some buffer for changing situations and variation across operating point and temperature. Make sure that no matter what happens, I don't have both devices turned on at the same time in this half bridge or phase lake configuration. Okay, with that, look at what happens with the switch. We'll do the easy ones first. When G1 is on, V switch should be up here at VDC. G2 is on, should be down here at zero. Then we switch back. The question is, what's going to happen during these dead times? Okay. And brief answer is, until I give you more details, don't really know. What's going to happen is, once we get the first device down below the threshold, we'll have both devices off. What we'll be left with is some equivalent circuit where the capacitances of the devices are sitting in there, locked to VDC, and I have IL potentially time varying going into that node, coming from wherever based on the rest of the makeup of this. Okay. If IL is positive, L is very big, such that IL can be well approximated as just a DC value. What's going to happen is it's going to flow into this node, it's going to split between these two capacitors, and it's going to tend to want to charge this one and discharge this one, both of which will bring V switch up. If IL is negative, it's going to do the opposite. It's going to pull out of this node, it's going to discharge this cap, charge this one, both of which tend to bring V switch down. So, for example, let's say IL is some big positive value in the direction that I've labeled it. IL is greater than zero. If I look at this transition, at this time, I turn off both devices. My current's going to flow into this node, going to go down through the low side capacitor and increase its voltage up through the high side capacitor. When V switch is zero, as VDC across it, I'm going to tend to bring that down. And I'm going to get something that looks like this. Okay. If ILT well approximated as a constant, and that constant is greater than zero, then I'll get something here where the slope of this is just a current charging these two capacitors effectively in parallel. So I'll get a slope that looks like IL over 2 CDS. It means that even if this is true, and if I have a huge inductor current going that way, the slope is still going to depend on the value of that current dictated by my operating point. So if I have a smaller inductor current, I could get something that looks like this. By the end of the dead time, this voltage is somewhere in between zero and VDC. Then I'm going to turn on the high side device. When I do, this becomes a small resistance. It's going to short out this capacitance and hard charge this capacitance through the voltage source. Something like this. If IL is much larger, it approaches infinite, I can shoot up the very steep slope. And during this dead time, neither of my MOSFET is going to turn on. So I'll go as high as a forward voltage, a diode forward voltage above VDC. If I try to go any higher, this diode turns on and clamps it. So I can go as high as kind of a VDC plus VF of the high side body diode. All depending on the value of that current. If inductance is small, and this is not true, then I won't get a constant slope. I'll get some resonant behavior that we'll look at a little later. What if this is true, inductance is big, but this is not, so the current is flowing that direction? What's going to happen? Exactly. So IL is less than zero, my slope's going to want to be negative, so it's going to try to go down. This voltage cannot go below minus VF. This voltage is more negative than ground by a forward voltage of the body diode. This body diode will turn on here. So what it'll do is it'll drop down, conduct through the body diode, continue doing that until the end of the period when I turn on the high side device, then at that point, rip this voltage up. As we look at the other transition, everything's going to apply the same, just we're trying to go the opposite direction. So now if IL is negative, that's a good thing. That'll tend to give us a negative DVDT and push us towards where we're trying to go. Anything like this, or for a big value like this, are IL less than zero. Anything like this is IL greater than zero. Let's try to push the voltage up. Current will go through the high side body diode. I'll switch here, discharging those capacitors. That, of course, jives with our motivation from the introduction that I'd like both of these transitions to be nice CVS transitions. I need the inductor current polarity to swap in between the two transitions. What I want is negative inductor current here to bring me down, positive inductor current here to charge me up at the VDC. So, with that in mind, look at what actually happens during these switching transitions for both cases of IL greater than zero and IL less than zero. Look at those by just looking at IL as a constant polarity and positive. Look at this transition and this transition separately. So applies the dual if IL is the other direction. But in any case, from this you can identify just looking at really what's happening, what's my equivalent circuit, and what's it going to try to do during the dead time, identify what type of transition you have. Do you have one where the voltage is going to stay locked and then hard switch, or do you have one where you have a potential to resonate, turn on with zero voltage? Next, just showing some cross sections of a MOSFET. This is a vertical power MOSFET. Be common for power applications, used for most devices above 40 volts and some a little below 40 volts. different from signal level devices, not a lateral device. Current conducts from one side of the die, the drain, up through the channel and out the source. When I'm conducting, I'll form a channel and inversion layer here underneath the gate in the body region, pulling conductors in from adjacent N-type regions to make a conductive N-type channel. This is an NMOS device. NMOS are going to be used for power applications due to the superior conduction characteristics of electrons over holes in silicon materials. The way these power devices are built up is through unit cells. So let's go blue. This be a symmetrical half cell, and a single unit cell of the device has source, a gate, drain body, and then that's just copied over and over in two dimensions to create a big device. Okay. Any of these individual cells would have very high ohms of on resistance, but I put a ton of them in parallel, short all their sources together through this kind of hatched areas, just metallization on top, to create a higher current device. This is all on a single die, very close to each other within a millimeter. Should be pretty well matched, share current fairly evenly. Okay. When I look at the off state, which I would get by putting the device in cutoff, or having VGS of zero or a little bit less than it, and then putting a negative drain to, or a positive drain to source voltage. In this case, drain being on the bottom, the source being drawn in the negative polarity. What I'm going to find is that these parasitic capacitances show up, and I'm going to choose to not get into a lot of detail on depletion region capacitances at the moment. I'll loop back to this in a couple lectures when we begin talking about nonlinearities of capacitance. For the moment, just to show where these things come from, for example, my gate to source capacitance, it's going to have components just from really adjacent conductors. So from the gate to the source metallization out here, from the gate down to the P-type body region, which is shorted to the source, and from the gate to these N wells, which are really the source of the device. That capacitance is going to be quite large, because I've got this gate everywhere, it's completely surrounded by source metallization. I've got kind of a parallel plate capacitance, small oxide thickness in between them over this whole thing. I'll have relatively smaller drain to source capacitances drawn here, which go across the depletion region. And then I'll have pretty darn small gate to drain capacitance, CGD, that's from the gate all the way down here to the drain. At a long distance, kind of a small area, should be a relatively small capacitance. Okay. We'll talk about how that depletion region plays out a little later. But for the moment, what I want to look at is really from the perspective of driving a device, how do gate to source capacitance, gate to drain capacitance affect operation? So this is plot of gate charge from an example device's data sheet. I'm plots like this on many of them, where it's total charge given to the gate, the integral of the current going into the gate versus gate to source voltage. Okay. So what does this mean in terms of driving the device? I sketch out example MOSFET. And I'm going to include a few parasitics. So this whole box is going to be my actual physical MOSFET. I'll consider the effect of gate-to-drain capacitance, gate-to-source capacitance, and perspective, I'm just going to look at driving it initially. So I'm not going to care as much about the drain to source capacitance, but that would be present as well. The other thing that any MOSFET will have is some gate resistance, inductance. And we could go into arbitrary order model here, adding more and more inductance in series with everything, capacitance in parallel with everything, keep going and going. This is a model of sufficient complexity to understand the behaviors. That gate resistance really comes from, if I drive this thing externally, what's the resistance to get kind of through this gate from my external circuit? I have this distributed gate where in each unit cell, got what is truly my gate, but it's driven somewhere externally. Depending on the device and how it's made, this gate may be made of metal or maybe made of polysilicon. Polysilicon is nice, a little bit easier manufacturing to get down real close to the channel, but it's a higher resistivity material than metal. We'll have some resistance to get from here down to any individual gate. Our G parameter, if it's given in a data sheet, is kind of a net parameter of distributed behavior, this resistance through all of the gate nodes. Okay. If it's a big polysilicon device, that may be a few ohms. The metal gate device, maybe a couple hundred milliohms. So when I drive this thing, I'm going to hook it up to a gate driver. And that gate driver, we looked at briefly before, is going to have inside some fairly high current pair of switches that can pull this gate node up to some drive voltage, VDR. And pull it down to a low level that is a nominal case, source of the MOSFET. It could potentially bias this to drive the gate to source voltage a little negative if I wanted. The purpose of this gate driver is really to buffer some control signal and translate it into potentially higher voltage. I may have a FPGA giving me a 3.3 volt input signal. Here's my PWM signal. Maybe I said 3.3 volts and a maximum of 10 milliamps. This thing is just going to make that signal show up here, but at the drive for a voltage and with the potential to drive much higher current. So we'll generally use fairly large devices here, such that the resistance of each of them is pretty low, down in the couple ohms or sub ohm range. We'll still have some amount of resistance, call this MH and ML. MH has some resistance RH, ML has some resistance RL. I'd like those to be pretty small. That way, when I short VGS to V drive, generate a lot of current and bring it up quickly. Okay. So I'm using this to do a level translation, provide high current to charge and discharge this capacitance, to make these devices big so that I can generate a lot of current. Then their gate to source has quite a bit of capacitance. So the implementation of this gate driver, this would actually go back, and I'd have a slightly smaller pair of FETs here that are big enough to drive those gates, and then slightly smaller. Each of these stages is functionally just an inverter. And I build up some number of stages, each cascaded one large enough to drive the next. That's more of an FYI. We'll really only look at this last stage, how it drives the MOSFET device. Okay, so what's going to happen at a switching transition? Well, say I look at turn on, trying to turn on my power device here. I will send the PWM signal, tells the drive to go high. That will turn this device on. It has a resistance of RH. That turn on, what I'll have is a circuit that looks like, neglecting the other stages, V drive through RH through RG, charging CGS and potentially CGD. Don't worry about the connections of these too much. Neglecting CGD for a moment, this looks a lot like homework one. If I sum these two things up, I have some voltage source charging through a resistor to charge a capacitor. Okay. I know that there's going to be loss on this resistor. If I only had CGS, it would be 1/2 CGS times V drive squared to charge this voltage from 0 to V drive. Okay. I also have some amount of current that's going to go up through the CGD capacitance. Talked about that a little bit previously. If I want to account for that as well, I'd have an additional 1/2 CV squared type term. Given the data that I have, easier way to express this is total charge times voltage. Okay. Using Q is equal to CV on any cap, my 1/2 CV squared becomes 1/2 QV. And given that I have the total charge that's applied to both of these caps and the voltage change at this node, I can say this is going to result in a total power loss of 1/2 QGV drive, where QG is the total charge that it took me to get to V drive. Say V drive is equal to 10 volts, and the total charge supplied is something like 17 nanocoulombs. I'll dissipate this amount of energy in the resistance for supplying this amount of energy to the caps. When I turn off, shut off this device, turn off this device, and try to bring the gate to source voltage from V drive down to 0, in doing so, I'm going to just short out the gate to source capacitance through these two resistances and dissipate all the energy that I supplied to them in the first place. So total turn off plus turn on, turn off plus turn on power loss, PG is going to be just QG VDR. And made a mistake here. This is energy. Apologize. 1/2 QV. To get the power, this is my total energy. I do that once per switching period. So I'm going to have QVGRFS, my total power loss. This loss comes from the drive supplied by the auxiliary supply. Not necessarily coming from your input voltage to your converter, which for what we're looking at, we haven't even established yet. It's coming from whatever is supplying the gate driver. the actual power consumption of the gate driver will be this plus any additional loss associated with the rest of the circuitry that we didn't consider. There's any loss in switching these devices, and so on. Any static losses for biasing and other things. Without looking at an individual part for a gate driver, just what's contributed by switching the MOSFET, I'm going to get this much loss. And depending on your application, this could be significant or completely insignificant. You've got some low switching frequency in small devices. This may be milliwatts. You have really large devices, but a whole lot of power. This may be a few watts, but your power dissipation budget is a kilowatt. It will not matter. So if I begin switching fast, this starts to become more significant, which is something you'll look at in homework. Okay. So questions on that? Move on. So this is the energy that's lost in this transition. This is going to be the energy dissipated on the resistors to bring this voltage up. So here, really works the same as in your homework, right? So VDR is going to supply QG V drive energy. Half of it's lost on the resistors, half of it goes to the caps. And then, kind of skipped over here, but if I looked at turn off, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this and I'm going to shut off RH, turn on RL, and I'm going to short out CGS, dissipating all of that energy, right? There's never any energy that goes back to the supply. Supply is QGV drive to turn on, and then whatever's left is dissipated during turn off. So all of it is eventually lost. You lose half here, you lose half and turn off, so the total is half plus a half QGV drive FS.
Okay, so how about the energy is in the RGS, right?
Right. Yeah. Let's actually just short it out. That's a nuanced question. On any of the homeworks, I'll try to make it clear if you should include this in the efficiency or not. Like I said, it depends on where you get V drive from. If you're sitting on your bench and you have a supply giving you 12 volts for V drive, and you got a 100 to 200 volt converter with a supply giving you 100 and a load where you're measuring the 200, and you just divide the powers of that input and output, you won't see this loss because it's coming from another supply, right? If the real application, you're not having benchtop supplies everywhere. So this V drive is somehow derived from your input voltage through a separate auxiliary converter. Then you'll see this power loss plus any efficiency through that auxiliary converter. Yeah. So it doesn't matter, and the reason why is because of, like I said, the you supply from V drive and nothing ever goes back to it, right? So all the energy that's supplied by V drive is lost. The total energy supplied is going to be V drive times the integral of the current coming out of here. Integral of current is the total charge. So if I have, I mean, I am somewhat limited by how accurate the manufacturers were, right? If they made a piecewise linear approximation, then it'll have some inaccuracies. But presuming this is correct, then the total charge is the integral of that current. And V times the integral of current is my correct total power supplied. And I'm going to eventually lose all of it. Whether I lose it here or there, it's gone. Right? Yeah. If you try to use half CV squared, you're going to run into a few problems. One is, what's the voltage on this, right? And that depends on something we'll look at next. The other is that these C's are nonlinear. They're going to change depending on the operating point. So one, it's difficult. Two, if you just use half CV squared, no, because half CV squared works for charging from zero to V. And this thing will go from some intermediate voltages from VDC minus VGS down to minus VGS, or depending on how you drive it. The 1/2 CV squared won't work directly. You can work it out if you do that math correctly with 1/2 CV squared, but you're going to have to take into account nonlinearities and what the actual voltages on thing are. It's going to require more information. Whereas using QG, you've got the integral of the gate current, and all that energy is lost. All the nonlinearities are already accounted for in what's going on here. So easier to calculate it this way.
So that 120 to 400 volts, that's like what the, like what connects to the PD is?
So that is the drain to source of the device. And particular numbers are relevant. I just picked one out of some data sheet. But in general, there will be a little bit of difference here. I may loop back to that in a moment. What we're going to talk about next is overlap loss, which will explain more why this shape is what it is. Okay. That's still unclear. Please bring it back up and after we talk about overlap. Yeah. No. Let's talk about overlap loss. Okay. You guys are getting ahead of me. It's a good question, but let me hop in here. Okay. So next thing I want to talk about, so that was really just talking about what I'm going to lose in the gate driver, but now let's talk about what this actually implies, the details of this waveform for how the device switches. Okay. So I am going to kind of hop back and forth between this slide where I show this QGVGS waveform and this slide where I'm going to plot the actual turn-on waveforms, the transient, for, say, the low-side device. Okay. So I want to look at turn-on of M2. I'll presume M1 is already shut off. Body diode is conducting, and I have some constant current IL. Simplify things a little bit for the moment. That is positive flowing in this direction. Okay. So I'm going to look in close detail at this turn on transient, not just presuming the device instantaneously goes from cutoff to triode, but actually what happens is I charge and discharge the gate. So the waveforms I'm going to plot here, I'm going to put VGS, the IDS, and VDS of M2. VDS, same as this V switch. Okay. So looking at turn on prior to the beginning of my time axis here, I'm going to presume that the device was off. So VGS was zero, IDS was zero, and VDS was at whatever VDC. And then at t is equal to zero, I'm going to begin this turn on process. To do so, I'm going to turn on that high side device in the gate driver and begin charging the gate to source capacitance, and VGS is going to start rising. As it does, where am I operating? Well, I've got initially zero VGS, some big VDS, zero current. I'm somewhere deep in cutoff. If I look at down here, the ID versus VDS transfer characteristic of the device, again, just an example one, don't worry about the numbers specifically as much as the trends. I'm somewhere in cutoff down here. This axis, anywhere down here with VGS is equal to zero, is cutoff. As I begin increasing the gate to source voltage, really nothing's going to happen until I hit threshold, right? VGS is less than threshold, no significant change. fill-in cutoff in my piecewise linear approximation. Okay. So I'm just going to extend this out until I hit the threshold voltage. So once I hit threshold, this device can start actually doing something. Until then, I have no change, just in cutoff. Okay, if I look at this previous plot, I pulled from the data sheet as well, what is the threshold voltage of this device? About 3 volts. So that's right here. Okay. Also have here the gate resistance for this device, it's about 2 ohms. So once I hit the threshold and go maybe just some epsilon above it, what starts happening? Well, I've got big drain to source voltage, initially zero current, and I'm just entering VGS greater than threshold, which is going to put me into the active sat region of the device, right? So the huge VDS, very small VGS. There, in this low active sat region, this thing's going to look like a voltage controlled current source, where I'm going to have an equation that looks like, in my active sat, let's say IDS about some forward transconductance times VGS minus VTH, where this forward transconductance is the property of the device of me for how much I'm above threshold, how much current is that current source going to sink. Okay. That is equivalently on my plot here, me moving this direction. Okay. Once I get out of cutoff, I'm jumping between these higher gate to source voltage curves. Now in my circuit, as I begin taking a small amount of current through the channel of this device, the voltage is not going to change because I have IL, say IL is 5 amps, I take 500 milliamps here, I'll have 4.5 amps going up through this diode, clamping this voltage up to VDC. And as I continue increasing the current, I'm going to continue taking over more of the inductor current. But until I take over all of IL, this diode can't shut off. The drain to source voltage is going to remain clamped. So what I'm going to see happen here is I'm going to continue increasing the threshold or the gate to source voltage. As I do, I'm going to take over more of the inductor current until I hit a point, call it Vm, where I've taken over all of IL, where when I solve this equation for VGS is equal to Vm, the current through the channel of the device is the complete inductor current IL. At that point, I've removed all current from the diode. The diode can shut off. And my voltage is no longer clamped, but up until then, diode clamps VDS at VDC. Make my plot. That's going to be this point. For this specific plot, 5 volts. This is where we're going to start to see a change in behavior. There's very little time to explain. What happens then? So the diode shuts off. Now, as I continue the switching transition, I'm in a really bad spot. So I've elevated up and up until I hit whatever BGS curve, let's say it's this one, gets me to a current of IL. Let's label these interval 1, 2, 3, and 4. Interval 1, I was sitting right here. Interval 2, I took over current. Interval 3, what's going to happen is I need to bring the drain to source voltage down. So I now have current source here. I'm stuck in still deep in the active sat region down here on the plot. I am over here in active sat. I eventually want to get into the triode ohmic region. As I continue trying to increase VGS, it's going to want to go to a current greater than IL. What's going to happen is instead it's going to collapse the voltage VDS, and I'm going to charge up through the gate to drain capacitance. And that's what you see happen here. See, as I continue supplying current, my gate to source voltage doesn't change, meaning none of that current is actually going in to the gate to source capacitance. It's actually all going up into the gate to drain capacitance. This is IG. Going up into the gate to drain capacitance, going to bring the drain to source voltage down, or equivalently the gate to drain voltage down when the gate to source voltage is constant. And again, getting the voltage on the device down so that it actually turns on. Okay. This section, all current into CGD. That interval is going to last as long as it takes to supply enough charge to get the gate to drain voltage down so that the device can pop out of the active sat region. During that, I'm going to have my gate current actually going through CGD, changing my drain to source voltage. That's going to look like no change in VGS because all the current is taken by the gate to drain capacitance. Presuming that current stays constant, linear decrease in my drain to source voltage. And that whole time, the device is conducting the entire inductor current. Once VDS reaches zero in my transfer characteristic, I've moved this direction, decreasing the voltage at a constant current till I pop out of active sat. At this point, I can finish the transition by just increasing VGS up to V drive. Here, the device has already gone into the triode or ohmic region. It already looks like a resistance. Increasing VGS just makes it a slightly smaller resistance. This is my interval 3. And then in interval 4, I end up on my intended operating point, conducting my inductor current with small voltage dictated by just the on resistance. Okay, I'm a little bit over on time, but quickly, what's the problem with this? Here, IDS, VDS, both greater than zero, means I'm gonna have power loss on this device during these times. Back here, don't care, because IDS is zero. Up here, don't care, because VDS is zero. But during intervals 2 and 3, a simultaneous VDS and IDS, it's gonna result in power loss. We'll pick up there on Friday.